Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Day Zero podcast. I'm Spectre, with me is Z. Today we have some various bugs, including a SAML authentication bypass and a curl SSRF, plus some other stuff. And research. One older paper that recently caught our attention that we found interesting and still wanted to cover. That being systematically discovering heap exploitation primitives. Some newer ones, like preventing UAS, and Samsung's real-time kernel protections for Android. First, though, we're going to talk about CTFs and a paper that was written on knowledge from them and how they can be transferred to the real world. So, primarily, the authors of this paper wanted to see how well CTF challenges could be mapped to the CSEC 2017 curricular guidelines. To do that, they mostly focus on distribution of challenges in the CTF space. So, they had three questions that they centered the paper around. What are the distribution of topics on CTF challenges? How does that distribution vary between different formats, and how that distribution evolved over the last decade? So the CSEC 2017 guidelines, they specify eight kinds of knowledge areas. They have data security, which includes crypto and forensics. That's where you'd see it translate in CTFs. Software security, which would be like your pwns. Component security, which I think would loosely translate to reverse engineering. Connection security, so NetSec, attack and defense would probably make more sense there.
Component security definitely goes wider than just reverse engineering. Reverse engineering is included there, but more generally just the security of components that are integrated into a larger system. I mean, a lot of these knowledge areas that they go into, they fit. They're obviously cybersecurity, like knowledge domains. They don't map really nicely with CTF challenges, though. I'm sorry, which was the last one that you mentioned? I interrupted with component security, but I think you also were saying the connection security?
Connection security, yeah, that was the last one.
Yeah, like connection security is another one where I think we'll probably get into this, but, talking kind of connection security, you kind of imagine TLS and like the, security of your actual connection. Whereas they kind of toss in like the entirety of attack and defense into there under CSAC. And there's just a lot of overlap in some things, but yeah, I just want to come in and say like component security, like that's where they put reverse engineering. But it's definitely more involved than just that. Like reverse engineering is like one bullet point on the entire list.
Yeah.
I actually do have the PDF of the entire list. I'll drop that in here too.
Okay. But among some of the other categories, you have system security, which again kind of overlaps with other categories. Human securities, like things like social engineering, which aren't really practiced in CTFs, really. Organizational security and societal security. So those last three are kind of there to translate, I think, which is something they touch on in the paper. So they wanted to have a methodology of categorizing those challenges into those knowledge areas. So what they ended up doing was they extracted keywords from the write-ups and cross-referenced them with the knowledge areas. They then revised the extraction and repeated that process. So overall, they got 1,623 keywords. And I think there's a table on page 17. I think it's like figure 7. And I think that sums it up pretty well. They have like a... Let me just go to that page really quick. So they have like a nice bar chart that shows CTF challenges, or rather CTF write-ups, and how they apply to those categories that we just mentioned. Now, there are some limitations there with that approach. A few of them they mentioned, such as the possibility for false positives, inability to double-check some of the write-ups due to them not including precise challenge information. One thing that I think they missed, though, or at least I didn't see it when I read that section, there could be a bit of a skew, because unfortunately some challenges just don't get written up. I've definitely seen that on CTF time, where I've tried to solve a challenge and then I look later for a solution and there's just no write-up posted. I don't know why. It's probably pretty rare, but it is a possibility that could skew the results a little bit, though probably not that much in all honesty.
Well, in terms of their numbers, they do actually give the number for like how many of the write-ups they were able to get, how many actually were useful. I forget what the exact number is. I want to say it was around 30-some thousand. Write-ups available, but they could only download about half of them, and then only about half of that half, so only about a quarter of the papers or write-ups match any keywords. I think the keyword thing is ultimately the destruction of this paper. I don't see a lot of value of this. I love the idea of this paper, but I'm going to be kind of critical here and just point out the fact that trying to map based on their keywords is just not going to be very effective. Because when you're doing a write-up, when you're writing something up, you can have these keywords in there, but that doesn't mean the challenge is actually about that thing. Like I mentioned, you know, if you mention like TCP, because, oh, I had to open a TCP connection to the service, suddenly you're getting hit up there as though it's part of like connection security. You're matching those keywords, even though the actual challenge might be completely unrelated to that. Maybe it is like a pwn or something, maybe it's not. Or, you know, mentioning HTTP, but, you know, it's a pwn.
Yeah, another thing I could see is matching, maybe, like...
Like, the most common keyword that it matched was log.
Yeah.
And password. On page 16, they actually have the list of their most common... Or I think it was page 16, the most common keywords. Yeah. Log, password... exploit, encrypt, class, pwn, HTTP, decrypt, crypto, and reverse. Like, those keywords do make sense. You would imagine seeing those in a CTF write-up. It's just, like, they're not really giving you a good idea of what the knowledge area of the challenge was just by looking at those keywords and for their presence and for how often they're present. I think that's just going to skew the entire thing. In addition to the fact that certain things actually kind of cover multiple domains, authentication or authorization, that's part of data security. That's part of human security also with identity management. I'm pretty sure that's also part of system security also. Might fall into some of the other ones too, but like they don't map really nicely. And just looking for the keywords, I feel like, is just a poor route to go on this.
I do kind of question why they wanted to map specifically to those categories, because like you were kind of pointing out there, there is a lot of overlap, and they're kind of vague, and I'm just trying to figure out what the drive is behind trying to match them up to those specific categories. They do kind of touch on it, but...
I can't pull up the... actual categories for you, like the PDF. I did drop the link in chat. You can kind of open it up for yourself, but they are reasonably well defined. Like, when it comes to the actual curriculum, these are reasonably well defined. It's just when you're talking about a challenge, they don't just necessarily neatly fit in there, especially when you're talking about like the keywords. Yeah, you can definitely take the crux of a challenge and like a single point in the challenge and define which area it goes to, but you don't get that by the keywords. They are defined fairly clearly in the original document. But like, so, I don't really fault them on that aspect of it. I just kind of come down on, like, I feel like there's a methodology issue because of the keywords just don't properly reflect a challenge.
The other thing I was thinking when I was reading this is I feel like this paper is extremely long to say not a lot. Like, I feel like you could probably summarize what this paper is getting at in like 2 to 3 pages, and it's like 32 pages. It seems very long-winded, but that's just what I was thinking when I was reading it. I mean, you know, when you're talking about like academia and stuff, that's not super uncommon. I mean, when it got to their conclusions, it's what you'd expect if you're familiar with the CTF space. Crypto and network security dominate, but some topics just can't really be covered well, such as the human element, which in the real world is more commonly attacked than anything.
They also mentioned like cybersecurity awareness should be covered more. It's like cybersecurity aware, like the people doing CTFs are generally going to be fairly aware of cybersecurity and all of that.
Yeah.
It's just, it's the wrong audience, too.
Yeah. So this is mainly just looking at categories. The other thing to keep in mind here is it's not really talking about how applicable CTF challenges are to real-world scenarios or anything like that. And that would be really hard to do, and that would be a lot to ask, I think, for this kind of study. But it's just keep that in mind. Even if they can map to these categories, it doesn't necessarily mean it translates into real world completely.
No, it just kind of gives you an idea of what's being covered. And I don't know, in this case, I just feel like it's lacking in even being able to do that.
So speaking of things that can be learned from CTFs, there was a write-up posted by Vax, which spawned from a PPCTF 2020 CTF challenge. And what's included in this post is more than just a challenge write-up, but also a universal deserialization gadget they discovered that worked for Ruby 2.x and 3.x. The reason they went looking for this is because the previously known universal gadget was patched in 2.7. And Z, I think you wanted to mention this just because getting gadgets for this type of attack is the crux of exploiting deserialization-based issues.
Yeah, well, having a universal deserialization gadget, or like having that universal gadget that you can use that doesn't rely upon any particular libraries being loaded outside of what's going to be available by default, basically means you can weaponize any deserialization issue. So in Ruby, we have had a previous kind of universal RCE deserialization gadget chain before that impacted something 2 series. This one, I actually forgot to look if it was currently patched or not. I would assume it's not. Yeah, it just mentions that it's working from Ruby 2 through Ruby 3. But yeah, like the hardest part of any deserialization is finding the gadgets that you can chain to get some useful other gadget. Normally, you're wanting to get remote code execution. So in this case, they walk through the details of how they came across the chain, kind of what the thought process was, which was a little bit interesting to read. What it came down to was they basically started off with this write adapter. You can control, or you can initialize the values of the socket and method ID, and when you end up calling the write, it calls the method ID. With a string there, so you don't necessarily you may or may not control what's being written, and they kind of get into how they get control of the write, how they get control of kind of everything through the net buffered IO has a log method that will end up calling the write on whatever you provide it. And they work through the whole process exactly as you'd expect for them talking through a deserialization gadget. The interesting on this one, though, is the fact that it is universal. You don't need to have, like, it's not dependent on it being a Rails application or some other common library like that.
Yeah, it's auto-loaded. So the POC they used was used to invoke the ID command via the kernel class's system method, which I believe, I don't really write Ruby, but I believe it's basically the equivalent of, like, shell or exec or something like that. And yeah, this is notable because, like you said, it's universal, it's auto-loaded, and it works across 2 different versions. No special modules required or anything like that. So we wanted to shout it out because this will be useful to anybody looking to exploit Ruby-based deserializations. So there was an interesting last-minute addition today because this article was just posted today. It was about stealing private videos from YouTube. It's a VRP-based post, Google VRP, that focuses on privacy settings, or rather bypassing privacy settings for videos. So with YouTube videos, you have 3 viewability settings. You have public, which is the most common, unlisted, where people with the ID or link can view it, but it doesn't show up on the channel page or search results or anything like that. And then private, which only logged in, authorized people can view that video. So this researcher wanted to see if they could somehow extract any information about private videos through whatever means. And what they eventually ended up trying was looking at services that weren't YouTube, but interacted with YouTube internally in the back end. And what they ended up finding was Google Ads did this through the analytics page. So they found an indirect object reference in the analytics page for Google Ads, which allowed them to pull moments or thumbnails from points in the video. And you can actually specify the time for those thumbnails. So you could go 33 milliseconds at a time for 24 FPS and basically reconstruct the video from thumbnails. So it's a cool bug. There are some caveats around this bug that make it not really practical to exploit, though. For one thing, you need the ID of the video, which is a really high requirement, because unless somebody leaks the ID or link to that video, you're not getting that, unless you have another really substantial bug to chain with it. You're also not getting audio, and the image quality kind of sucks. So there's some circumstances around this bug.
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely make out kind of what's going on in a video, but yeah, like I said, any audio is going to be there, so that's definitely a limitation. In terms of the IDs, early video IDs can still kind of be figured out. I believe the way early IDs worked, so it was essentially an encryption of an ID. So you can kind of decrypt or encrypt them yourself because that key leaked some years ago. That said, I'm talking about very early videos, nothing new. And, you know, if I were to imagine a case where this were actually used, it would probably be on a new video, like trying to get insight into like some company's new release by leaking their video before it's actually public. But beyond that, like, I can't imagine there being a lot of value in leaking in an older video. And yeah, now so, I imagine it's harder to get the ID, too.
Yeah. So he ended up getting a 5K payout from this, from Google. And there's been some people saying that this bounty payout is low at 5K, could have gotten way more. Yeah, no. When you look at the circumstances around the bug, And like, consider, like, what are you really going to use this for? You're getting private YouTube videos. It's not like you're getting somebody's personal identification information or anything like that. Like, the attack scenarios here are very limited. And then when you pile on the caveats around the exploit, this is one of those bugs that falls into the category of it's neat, and the researchers should be, like, happy with this finding, but it's not really practical to abuse. Like, It's cool, and that's kind of all, in my opinion, anyway.
I mean, it's, I would have, it would depend on who you're thinking about as the attacker. Like, it's one thing to try and sell something. In this case, I'd say, like, there's probably no buyer for this.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, if somebody had something against either a particular company or maybe against YouTube or Google, and were specifically looking for issues they could abuse, and then came across that, I could imagine ways that they could abuse it, but it's not something that somebody would be actively really seeking out. It's more of a target of opportunity type thing, rather than, like, I'm going to go and sell this on the black market. Because, frankly, like, odds are nobody's really asking for this. The sale, I mean, I was reading Hacker News earlier in comments, you know, that this would be tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of dollars. There's no way this is hundreds of thousands, like, straight up.
There's no way.
Tens of thousands is very much a stretch. Like, I mean, even take the reward of 5,000.
I think that's very generous.
Yeah, I mean, it could be hard to even sell it at that.
Yeah, exactly. That was my thought as well.
I mean, in all fairness, like, I'm definitely not an expert in selling on the black market or anything. But I know enough to say that, like, things like this, which impact, like, a specific website, generally, unless they're exposing a lot of information, like a SQL injection or something, or obviously code execution on the server, some of that. Although even code execution kind of varies because of how good the opposition would be in that sense. Like, if you were to exploit it, how likely are you to get caught? Like, that does have an impact on some of it, too. But anyway, with something like this, it can get patched instantly, which just kills the entire life of it. It is instantly worthless.
Yeah.
That brings prices down a lot because there's no tail end. It's not like, you know, a Android exploit where there's kind of that life after it's been patched. It's like they can still use on people who haven't patched it yet or on any software that just is widely deployed. They can reuse this elsewhere. In this case, They can't. Once it's patched, it's patched, and it's patched for good for everybody.
And one idea I saw thrown around a little bit was like turning this into a service where you pay a subscription and you can put links in and like get the videos or whatever. I mean, the problem with that is this type of bug leaves indicators of compromise, I guess would be the best term for that, in the way that it would be very easy for Google to see something is going on here, because I mean, think about it, you're pulling images from a video every 33 milliseconds. They're going to be able to see that in logs, and they're going to be like, okay, what the hell are you doing here? And then they're going to look more closely. Like, it's not going to take long for them to find the issue and patch it if this was being used in the wild, so to speak.
Well, so, and especially if it was a service. If it's a service, somebody from Google just goes, enters a video ID they know and sees, oh, hey, there's suddenly a massive request for, like, all these screenshots of it.
Yeah.
I wonder what that's about.
Yeah, it would be found and fixed in under a day. So your service wouldn't last very long. So, yeah. It's not really.
I can imagine taking longer for them to find out about the service, but yeah, no, $5,000 for it's an eyedore is a fairly reasonable offering from Google. Like, I don't think Google is really trying to shortchange bug hunters. I mean, bug hunting isn't the most profitable option, but I don't think they're shortchanging in this case at all.
Yeah, definitely not. So, keeping on the topic of bug bounties, we have a Rocket Chat issue on HackerOne, a SAML authentication bypass in Rocket Chat. Essentially, there's an exposed Meteor that allows you to add a SAML service, which defaults to disabled signature verification, and allows you to add a service under any name, and there's no authentication on that. So, it just seems like it's an endpoint that should have never been exposed. I don't know if maybe it was used in development or something, and it just wasn't removed in production. I'm not sure what the backstory would be behind that.
So with Meteor, one of the points of Meteor is the fact that it makes it easy to share code between your back end, your front end, and you just using the same code along the entire stack. So in this case, it basically set this method, shouldn't have been made public, but it was just kind of added as one of the publicly exposed parts of the class. So I will say that the issue is a little bit more complicated. When you adding a custom sample, you're not going to have too many accounts there that are actually valid. What actually happens with this one is if you create the name, so if you have an existing SAML, if the application has an existing SAML set up, they have some name for it. They use the example of default as a name, which is just kind of obviously a default name. If you use default underscore cert, you're able to set the settings for the dot cert value when it grabs that name. So that's where the issue kind of comes in, is you're able to set the dot cert property value, and you set that to something that's falsy, and it just treats as though there's no cert, therefore let's not validate the cert any longer.
So the impact here was a critical impact, because it essentially allowed you to bypass authentication and log in as any user, including admins, which unfortunately there's no payout here. I looked at the vendor's bounty page. They don't have like a payout table, so that's fair enough. It is kind of sad though when you see like these really critical issues and it's like you just get like a thank you. But I mean, that when you're looking at a target, that's one of the things you've got to assess. And, you know, the researcher probably knew that going into it anyway. One thing I thought I'd point out that I thought was cool in the comments thread, the researcher added an indicator of compromise in there. I don't remember exactly which comment it was, but they added, the presence of settings such as SAML custom cert. That's something I think would be awesome if we saw more of in bug reports. Even though in this case it might be a bit of a more obvious indicator of compromise, in some other cases it might not be, other than to the researcher who found the issue. So that would be something that would be cool to see in future bug reports. I don't know if you would agree with that.
Yeah, well, it's hard. I mean, I would not expect somebody to actually include that in a bug report because it's hard to know.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't expect it. It's so dependent. I just think it's cool to have, like, as a bonus.
Sure, I mean, but it's a side effect of the fact that you're taking advantage of this settings.add functionality, which kind of takes the name and I'm assuming it parses it based on those underscores. So you're basically setting a name that includes an underscore in order to set that extra serf value. And kind of overload some that was already there loaded from elsewhere.
Yeah, that makes
but
sense.
If you're going to try and do the indicator of compromise, it's like you need to kind of know what the back end looks like, and a lot of bug reports just don't know that. They wouldn't know necessarily what everything looks like. I mean, if you're dealing with an open source, you might be able to, but it might not leave a clear trace either.
Yeah, that's a fair point. But yeah, I mean, interesting report. Always fun to see critical stuff. Our next report, I believe, is also critical. It's the SSRF in curl. This one's actually...
Well, I mean, it's critical. Yeah. It's given that severity, it's closed as information or informative.
Yeah, because it's a really complicated issue.
Oh, no, it's a simple issue.
Well, it's complicated, from a fixability standpoint. The issue is straightforward, but...
I mean, basically, this one got rejected. It's not going to get fixed. In terms of... And I do agree with the developer on this one. So, the issue here with curl is effectively... they provide the couple example URLs here. And you'll notice they use this backslash before the at sign. And that's kind of where the issues come in. In the case of Node, their default like new URL, if you go and try and grab the host name of a URL like that, they'll print google.com as the host name. But with curl, it'll make its request to yahoo.com. And this comes down to a difference with what WG uses versus whatever RFC 3986. So curl follows the RFC 3986, which indicates that at sign is the separator. You have that at sign. Before that is the username and password. After that is the actual domain. That's it. Well, what WG does, and that's more common in the browsers, will use that, which is probably why V8 with Node is also using it. What they'll do is if you have a backslash before, you can kind of escape the at sign. So in that case, they're parsing as, okay, well, that's escape. So just kind of part of the path that exists there. And so the domain itself, the host name is Google. It's the first part of it. So I kind of agree with them following the spec. I'm not going to blame them for following the spec. What WG is constantly changing. It's a living URL spec, so nobody, you know, fully follows it. Or it's impossible to continually follow it. I really don't blame them for that change. I kind of like this report because I've seen this in the wild before also. Being able to take advantage of this where something did some validation on a request that you were about to make and then pass your URL into curl, which parse the URL differently. It's worth being aware of. That's why I wanted to kind of call it out as an issue. Like, I kind of agree. RFC says one thing, they're following the RFC. I'm good with that.
Yeah, so I guess where I'll say, I was saying the situation was a little bit complex earlier, was the fact that this isn't really a technical bug and more just comes down to a difference of specification. And that's not something you can easily just solve, which is why this was closed as informative. I would like to thank Nahemsek for the raid. Yes, 106 new champions coming in. Thank you.
Quite a large raid, or...
For sure, man. Thank you. So yeah, the situation gets a little bit complex because this is kind of what this kind of reminds me of is like a desync attack. It's kind of like the URL equivalent the URL equivalent of like the desync attacks that we've covered before with HTTP, kind of.
Okay, so when you said desync, I was definitely kind of wondering, like, where are you going with this? I kind of get what you're pointing at now when you say that. And yeah, that's actually a good way to describe it, I guess, at least if you're familiar with a desync attack. Because, it basically relies on one part, the front end, parsing it one way, your back end, in this case, curl, parsing it another way. Definitely something I've seen before, so it's worth keeping an eye out for, and I don't believe we've talked about this at all before. So, I want to kind of call it out.
Yeah. One thing that I found interesting that I wanted to talk about was this was actually reported in September of 2019, but it only recently got disclosed, like last week. Given that this was closed as informative and it was like a difference of standards, I wonder why it took so long for it to go from like reported to disclosed. I don't know if it was maybe just a case of they just forgot about the report maybe or something. I don't know. But I thought that was an interesting time lag between the report date and the disclosure date. Usually, especially reports that are closed as informative are closed pretty quickly to when they're opened. But yeah, just something I thought I'd point out. All right. So we can move on to our...
I will just point out that it was also Curl that made the request to disclose this. It was Badger from the Curl staff.
Yeah.
So something probably just changed kind of on their end.
Yeah. So we can move into our last exploit of the stream before we get into research, which is Node.js. There was a use after free and TLS wrap. So this is Node's TLS implementation. And this issue seems to come down to a classic bad return path issue. Basically, if an error occurs when writing to a TLS-enabled socket, the write wrap object will get freed. And if it succeeds, that object will then get returned back up to the caller. So this called function gets passed an object through parameter, and it returns error. The problem is there's a path where the object gets freed, but no error gets returned. And that happens when attempting to write to the underlying stream, which can be triggered very easily. All you have to do is close the socket on the other end right before the write to trigger a pipe error. And the funny thing is, they guess that this issue probably has been encountered a lot because broken pipes are something that should happen a lot when you're running like an HTTPS server application. But the corruption isn't noisy enough to cause a crash. They stated when they tried this POC against the target, it didn't cause a crash unless a SAN was built in, which obviously production builds are not going to have address sanitization compiled into it. So it's kind of up in the air how exploitable this issue is. They point out it could potentially be exploitable if the heap could be manipulated sufficiently to allow like a chunk to merge with a larger chunk in the free, for example.
I wouldn't be surprised about it. I mean, given the complexity of Node.js and the I guess it depends on the application, obviously, written using this, but given the complexity, there's definitely going to be a lot of room for that sort of heap grooming. So, I mean, it's up in the air, especially when you think about the applications. Kind of small, like it's not the browser, it's not something really obvious. Like, but it is an entire JavaScript engine that you've got here to work with. So the potential is definitely there. It would be a lot of work to get it, but yeah, it's there. And like I said, it's one of those really easy issues where it's just you've got this error case and you just forget to return the error code. So one part of the application again thinks it was successful and keeps using this object, whereas it knows this is freed.
Yeah, I mean, this type of UAF is probably the most common type of UAF you'll see. Errors can be tricky to handle, and sometimes being lazy and failing to handle an error can very quickly turn into like a memory corruption. So yeah, if you're looking for UAFs, this is probably the type of issue that you want to keep a lookout for, especially in cases where you're not, like race conditions aren't really a consideration if you're running like a single-threaded application. This is probably like your best bet of something to look for if you're looking for real world stuff.
Yeah, and I guess the other code smell that's worth being aware of with this one is this, you'll notice here with the return, it's return zero. Okay, it might have been the actual code and not what they had here. But just noticing when an application kind of deviates from its normal case where it's return zero, it's returning something, and then it's just return nothing. Like when it deviates from that, that's one of those things where it's, you know, take a closer look. Obviously, when you're dealing with a huge application like the size of Node.js, you're maybe not going to notice that as easily. Like it's really easy for us to sit here and be like, yeah, you just noticed this. It's a lot more difficult to do in person, in practice, but you know, it's a code smell to be aware of when you notice that sort of change from the norm.
It's weird, actually. Now that you point that out, that should throw a compiler warning, should it not? When you try to return nothing on a non-void function? That should be throwing a warning.
No. So this function itself isn't expected to return, but when you look at how everything else is being handled, where everything else has the error checks.
Oh, right, I see. Okay, yeah, sorry, it's a void function, then it gets...
Yeah, I was just using the returns here as, like, the case to point out, but, yeah, in this code, it was... That wouldn't be throwing an error.
Yeah, that's fair. Warning. Yeah, it's a void function that's called by a function that doesn't return void. Yeah, okay. But yeah, just interesting cases to look out for sure. So getting into some research papers. Our first research paper is focused on actually stopping UAF attacks by using one-time allocators. So this defense approach is abusing the fact that in order to exploit use after freeze, attackers have to get either data they control or a target object to overlap with the freed allocation. As that's essentially how UAFs work in exploit dev. You're trying to get some kind of data overlapping with whatever you're UAFing to get it to either operate on that data, like write something there, or read that data, which could potentially bypass validation or whatever. And what this allocator does is basically go, okay, we have a bunch of virtual address space, especially since systems are mostly 64-bit now. Let's just make it so you can't reallocate at the same address and overlap. So the concept is pretty easy to grasp. It's pretty straightforward. The implementation gets pretty tricky, though. There's been some past allocators that have attempted this with some drawbacks. There's one called Die Harder, which allocates random addresses, but there's no guarantee that there's no overlaps. It's just probable that you won't have any overlaps. There's also Archipelago, which uses distinct physical pages. And Oscar does something similar by creating shadow pages, but both had significant performance issues because you're using syscalls a lot in allocations, and you end up with like more than a 40% performance overhead when you do that. So what they did was they introduced their own allocator, which they call the fast forward malloc. And this merges two implementations that they had for, or first two initial methods that they had.
Yeah, so before dig into that detail, I do want to jump back, okay, just talk with the one-time allocation. When I first started reading this paper, I was thinking, like, there's no way this is going to be practical. And to be fair, now that I've read the paper, I still think, you know, this isn't really practical. But it seems a lot more reasonable. Of course, the first thing I thought was, you know, this is basically, you know, you just never free. It's the same. I mean, it's not exactly the same idea, but in principle, if you were to never free, you would never have a use after free. It's kind of taking advantage of that same idea. In this case, though, it's, you know, you do have a lot of memory space and like a lot of possible addresses that most people just aren't going to be using in their applications. So, you know, the more I thought about it, the more it's like, okay, maybe there is something to this. They do raise also some of the challenges, and that's where they get into the different allocations. Their first attempt at this was their forward continuous allocator, which just had a pointer that tracked the end of the last allocation. Every time you make a new alloc, just increment it. It's kind of the naive way of implementing this.
It's basically a bump allocator.
Yeah. And then they had the forward binning allocator, which was their second attempt there. Basically, it does some binning. It groups them up into different sizes, so all the allocations under 4096 bytes, they'd group them up into a few different chunks, and then everything kind of within this chunk range would get allocated in its own bin. That kind of gives you, just allocating a page per bin, you get some benefits of like memory savings out of that. FFmalloc, their final decision here, combines the two, does binning for allocations up to 2048 bytes. This prevents kind of those small and long-lived allocations from holding on to a page before it can get freed, which I guess I should have mentioned earlier is kind of one of the key issues that they need to deal with, is you can't free a memory page until everything on that page has been freed, which means you can have like a really well-placed single allocation that maybe isn't very large, but it actually holds like two entire pages of memory because it straddles that boundary. So, I mean, like, they had to kind of think of some of those issues. So that's where they started doing the binning to group things together, allowing them to kind of play with the sizes a little bit more tightly and prevent kind of that straddling from happening. And then for larger allocations, they can just go ahead and use the continuous allocator, just marking where it's marking where the end of it is. The stats here, was there anything else you want to say about the implementation, Spectre?
I did just want to clarify on that. I believe they use the continuous allocation inside of the bins as well, right? Or am I mistaken
yes.
there?
Okay. Yes, no, they did.
Yeah, okay. I just wanted to clarify on that point, because I have something to bring it around to later. Yeah, you can continue on with the stats.
Yeah, well, I mean, the stats were interesting. Performance-wise, they talk about, or they ran this against SpecCPU 2006, which is, we actually talked about another one of the allocators they compare with here. We talked about Marcus back on episode 39, I believe it was. And so they end up comparing themselves a lot with Marcus. And one of the issues that we brought up with Marcus was the fact that it was this use after free prevention, or, well, preventative allocator, and they only basically ran it against, like, GCC. They basically ran it against a spec CPU, like, the same benchmark here. So I appreciate the fact that we actually do have a bit of a comparison between the two, but also that when it came to the stats, FFmalloc, they, you know, went through the effort to actually test against a couple of real-world cases, i.e. Chakra Core and Nginx. It's definitely an issue that we complain about a lot on the podcast, is bad benchmarks or bad choices of benchmarks.
Cherry picked, yeah. That's what they seem most often.
Well, cherry picked are just like ones that don't make sense. Like, I kind of get why spec CPU is chosen, because it is a selection of, like, it's a consistent benchmark to use. Like, there is kind of a reason for it. It doesn't make sense for this particular use case. So I appreciate that we got it for comparison with the other options. But, you know, they gave us, you know, the proper, or what I would say as proper information there. So they do look at the Chakra Core, the CPU usage. Generally not too far off. I did notice that they have maybe an inconsistent use of the negative signs. Because red means that it was performing worse, and green means it was performing better. So I don't know how, like, the 1.88% in the red but not negative compares with the negative 0.16, or if they're both, both going negative. Like, they should both be negative, I believe, but I noticed that inconsistency. I'm not sure if you did. But I mean, generally speaking, yeah, it looked like the CPU overhead wasn't too bad, but that memory overhead getting up to like 500%, 300%, that's basically going to kill a lot of its use outside of any sort of high security use case.
So they did test against the various exploits. I think they tried like 6 CVEs and 5 CTF challenges.
It was effective.
Yeah, it was very effective, as you would expect with the methodology they chose.
Yeah, like, I definitely am not surprised by the fact that this choice is effective. You know, you can't really have a use after free without the reuse.
Yeah. That memory overhead can be quite significant. I'm not sure if you mentioned this, because I was reading something quickly while you were going over that, but settings can be tweaked to try to balance those overheads. So you can tweak it to release memory more often to relieve memory pressure at the expense of higher performance cost. I like the exploration of this. I will say, though, I don't believe the method is entirely new. I think this strategy is somewhat used in browsers as well. Not the like shadow map checking for the one-time allocation, but which is the main focus of this paper, to be fair, but the bump allocation combined with binning. I'm pretty confident browser engines like WebKit have been doing this for a while, because I actually had to deal with that when I was exploiting a heap buffer overflow in WebKit a few years ago. I had to get a buffer allocated before my target buffer, where I had corruption.
That's common with most allocators. Binning is more of a performance thing, and that's why they end up using it too.
Yeah, but I mean, the browsers also do that bump allocation as well alongside of it. So, that's a fairly common thing. But yeah, I mean, I kind of liked where this paper was going, but like you were mentioning, the performance impacts were really high. And unfortunately, that's the case with a lot of the like defensive papers we look at, is they look cool, they sound awesome until you look at the like the measured performance impacts, and it's like, oh man. Well, I guess that's not really going to be.
It's a starting place in a sense. That said, I still think the one-time allocation is just kind of to be relegated to. It's an interesting thought experiment, but maybe not practical. Now, if you have some high security application, maybe you're willing to make that trade-off. But that trade-off comes at a cost. So I want to also talk about, at the end of this paper, they talk about randomization. And one of the concerns people may have is that ASLR, or you may be concerned, quoting the paper here, one can be concerned that FFmalloc may diminish the effectiveness of ASLR due to the sequential allocation scheme. From that, it's a reasonable concern. It seems like the paper authors don't quite get where people are coming from when that concern is raised. So their response is simply pointing out the fact that, you know, it uses the default heap star location. So when the operating system basically gives it that area, gives it that offset to actually start its heap at, that is ASLR, and they're good to go. And that's true. When you're talking about just ASLR in that case, like if you're using the very technical definition, they're correct. But the issue is that you do lose randomization when you are purely only kind of advancing that pointer. Most of your allocations are going to be purely like incremental. Because of the binning, you don't quite have that. But you roughly have that. And you're able to predict a lot about what your offsets are going to be from other allocations, especially when you control some of that. You're going to know, okay, this is allocated around this spot after this and this. You lose some of that. That's where I think you're losing the randomization. Not in the true ASLR, but in terms of heap grooming, especially in terms of what you're able to do with an overflow in this allocator, I'm not sure the trade-off's worth it just to deal with the UAF.
Yeah, I mean, effectively, your heap almost turns into a stack when it comes to determinism because of that bump allocation aspect. So even though you're starting at a random offset, I mean, one thing you can do, and we actually talked about this a little bit with the last PS4 WebKit exploit, is if you have a lot of control over how much gets allocated on the heap, you can just make it so much stuff gets allocated that you can guess the location of a heap address pretty easily. And then you could potentially just crawl it. Like if you have a read primitive, you can just crawl the heap to find whatever you're looking for. So yeah, the heap becomes very deterministic in this type of allocator.
Yeah, and I think heap overflows are still very common. So I think that's like to be giving up the security there in exchange for no UAF. Like I'm not, and especially with the memory overhead, I'm not sure it's worth that basically.
I did want to pull a quick question out of chat. Do you have a site for these paper releases, or do you hear from others, or do you go to all the sources yourself? We do have a feed that we have. A lot of the papers that we cover can be found on Archive, which is where you find the pre-publish. What's the proper term for it?
Print. Sorry. I use Archive for a lot of it. I just follow the was it computer security or crypto? I forget exact CS. Basically, I follow the computer science security feed. I'll occasionally look into some of the other comp sci things because there are sometimes papers there too. In this case, this was actually at Unix Security 2020. So that's where I saw it. I'm just going through the list of those papers. Which is also where I got the next paper that we'll be covering. And so that was in August, which is a little bit old for us to be covering. This one in particular is Unix Security 2021. So it's accepted but hasn't been presented yet. The next one is from August. So I follow a bunch of conferences also to get some of the sources, at least for the papers. Basically, I've just got a big list of like 100-150 different feeds that I go through every week.
Yeah. So speaking of that next paper, I think we can probably jump into it now. So as you already mentioned, it is a bit old. It's from Usenix 2020, but it's kind of new to us, and we found it interesting. So we thought we would we would cover it anyway.
Definitely interesting, but the paper, like this paper actually goes back to, it was first pre-printed in March of 2019. And then not actually presented Unix Security in August. So that's why we're covering it now, but this is probably the oldest paper we've covered on the podcast.
Yeah. So what this paper aims to do is introduce a tool to discover new heap exploit primitives called ArcHeap. And they also ended up discovering new techniques to demonstrate the usefulness of their tool. I think they discovered 5 new techniques in PT-Malloc 2 and several others and other allocators, which I don't think they go into high detail on in this paper. I think they mostly focus on PT-Malloc. So when you're talking about heap exploitation, there's quite a few strategies that you can try depending on your allocator you're targeting, right? You could hit metadata, like some of the house of attacks. You could abuse how the allocator itself works with things like chunk merging or hitting double freeze and poisoning the free list if the free list isn't hardened. And then you try to take that to get some kind of higher primitive. So like code execution, arbitrary read write, info disclosure, whatever you need to make your exploit chain work. So what they did was they created a model which factors in the types of bugs that you'll see in the heap. So like overflow, arbitrary free, double free, stuff like that, as well as the impact of exploitation. So what it gives you, like maybe arbitrary chunk, overlapping chunk, arbitrary write, restricted write. And then they basically fuzz the allocator. So their tool will run a bunch of heap actions, like allocations, free, writing, bug invocation. And they try to see if that test case can be used for a better corruption primitive, and they classify it into that model. So one of the nice things about this method, since it is basically fuzzing, is the fact that you're not really going to get any false positives like you would with static analysis, which has been a problem in some of the heap-based papers we've covered before, because some of the heap stuff we've covered before has been static analysis. And the number of false positives were kind of killed the usefulness of the paper a little bit. But here, it is basically fuzzing. That's what I think this paper could be summed up as. You're fuzzing the heap allocator. Like I said earlier, they did find some new techniques. These are all on page 10 and downwards. In PT-Malloc, I'm not going to go over all of them, but the three first ones, which I found most interesting, were they found an unsorted bin into stack ability, which overwrites the unsorted bin to link a false chunk. House of Unsorted Enherjar. I don't know how to say that. I'm just going to assume I said it. Aranar? Okay.
That one is a bit of a newer heap attack. I'm not entirely sure if it's actually a novel attack here. It combines that with Unsorted Bin attack, basically to remove your need for needing to leak an address first. I feel like I've seen something similar to it. Oh no, for some reason I was thinking it was actually the null poisoning attack. That said, I don't think it is, because they definitely would have been aware of that. So they don't include enough information for us to know, but I can kind of see why somebody could describe that one in those words. So yeah, I'm not entirely sure if that one is actually novel. Nonetheless, the fact that this thing found it is great. I think this is a really interesting paper, definitely promising. It did find some new things. Besides that one, which I'm not sure about, and even regardless, it still found it. Like, that's still great if it finds the older stuff too, which you would basically expect it to find. Seemed fine. It also found issues in some of the hardened allocators, which they don't go into details about, but it was able to find issues there also, which, I mean, is huge because you're able to run this just against any sort of heap, any sort of allocator, and get something out of it. Sorry, I kind of cut you off there.
Yeah, no worries. I was just going to say, I think with the House of BNR, I think that one was there before, but what's novel about theirs is it doesn't require a previous breaking of ASLR.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Believe, so for some reason, while I was going through the paper, I was thinking of the null byte attack could be described as using the unsorted. So what they described this one as, do you recall what page that's on?
I think that was on page 11 when they talked about that, but if memory serves.
Well, if I could count, I'd be able to find it, but I was looking at the wrong page.
Okay, it might have been page 10. Yeah, page 10 talks about
It describes as a variant of House of Erenhar, which uses off by one null byte overflow, which is the base attack, and returns an arbitrary chunk. And then they use the unsorted bin attack to break ASLR. If you're not familiar, unsorted bin basically just ends up writing the unsorted bin's arena address to an address that you control. So it does seem like it's probably novel. I feel it just seems so familiar to me also. So I don't know if anybody in chat might recognize it. And I'm not trying to downplay the paper because I think it's awesome regardless. And yeah, the other ones definitely do seem different. So talking about the results here, it provides a C proof, a concept which is reasonably easy for it to get. It's dealing with the heap. It kind of knows the code it's running. It does do some minimizing, which seems reasonably effective. I think this is very promising and likely to be fairly useful when it comes to dealing with allocators that haven't been well examined. I think that's kind of going to be the key thing here. This is generalized enough that you can run this against kind of your arbitrary allocator. Might not work against all of them, to be fair. You know, some of them might just do something very different. They make several assumptions about the structure of the allocator, about the fact that it's probably going to be doing some binning, so they choose their sizes based around certain bin sizes, based around the fact there's probably, if there's metadata, it's probably not random data. So they use pointers or sizes. They make several assumptions basically to reduce the search space, but it seems effective. Like, I genuinely think this will be useful when it comes to dealing with the allocators that are less commonly looked at. I mean, it's interesting that I found some new things in ptmalloc, which is the default allocator, like libc or glibc. But even without that, I keep harping on that same point. The things that aren't looked at as much, I think, is where this will shine.
Yeah. I mean, what I kind of wonder, like a question that I was thinking of when you were covering how useful this paper is and how practical it'll be. I wonder where this will fall in the usefulness category and comparing like attack to defense. I feel like this can be obviously be used for both. If you're looking to attack an allocator, you can use this tool or the idea of this tool, at least, to find corruption primitives that are useful to you that you could potentially use to full chain or something, right? It can also be used in a defensive context to try to harden your allocator against whatever it finds. I think this might be more useful on the attack side, though, just because I could see this finding so many issues in especially the less common allocators that it might just bog down the developers to the point where they're like, wow, okay, there's a lot of potential primitives that can be gained from our allocator. Which ones can we really do something about, and which ones do we just kind of push off and ignore?
I mean, lot of the lesser used allocators are like the more security oriented ones, so hopefully that won't be the case. I mean, that isn't to say a lot of applications also do go and implement their own allocator because they think they can do it better than whoever's written the other ones.
Reinvent the wheel. Yeah.
Yeah, so that definitely happens, and they usually have some very trivial options that you wouldn't even need to run this against. So I'm definitely thinking more about the security-hardened ones than just kind of the random bogged-down one. I think it could be used defensively, for sure. That's a really good point. And in fact, it should be used defensively. I mean, I've said it before, but if you're like, fuzzing should be part of the development process.
Yeah, I agree. It's just interesting to see if it actually will be, because
it's research, so I doubt it. Like, being honest here, I doubt it will see much adoption, but I do think it's promising nonetheless.
Yeah, maybe there should be a push for it to see some adoption, though, because I think it's a good idea. All right, so we'll move into our last research post. This is a really long research post with a lot of background detail that I'm not going to go into here. There is some stuff I want to pick out and cover, though. So this is a really awesome research post that was posted by Alexander Adamski at Long Term Security, and it's about Samsung's RKP, real-time kernel protection, and kernel exploitation on Android when it comes to Samsung devices. So that includes the kernel mitigations that are provided by Samsung, and the reason they're able to get away with these is Samsung has something called Nox, which includes a hypervisor, which they go into a lot of detail about in this post, which I'm going to mostly skip over in the interest of time. But some of the mitigations that are provided include JOP prevention, jump-oriented programming prevention, return-oriented programming prevention, and data protection. And as well as the background information on how that's facilitated.
Just worth kind of pointing out here that both of those, the JOP and the ROP prevention, are more or less what you would expect the implementations to be, just in instrumenting the calls, basically, or instrumenting the returns for the ROP. Nothing's too surprising about what they do there. I just wanted to kind of point that out, because at least prior to this, I hadn't really looked into all the details of the implementation. I was actually kind of surprised by how simple the JOP one is in particular, which is there. It's basically like a homemade CFI. And it just implements all the, or instruments all the indirect calls. So it's broken in pretty much the same way most of the very non-granular CFIs would be, in that you can still reuse like the larger blocks or function calls. You just can't do the really granular, like jumping into the, well, doesn't really work with ARM, but jumping into the middle of an instruction would be the classic example there.
Yeah. The third one, the kernel data protection, I think is probably the most interesting one to me, because like you said, we've kind of had CFI being explored for ROP and JOP prevention. But the kernel data protection, it basically uses the hypervisor to make critical structures in memory read-only, or at least parts of it read-only after initialization. So that would be like the task info struct and stuff like that. And they also detail a vulnerability that they found in RKP. The vulnerability will require background knowledge on the internals to understand intimately, but at a high level, they have a function that gets a physical address for a virtual address, for a matching virtual address, when verifying kernel input into the hypervisor, called RKP get PA. And it does some checks on that address, because obviously when your kernel and your passing address is in, the hypervisor doesn't want you messing with hypervisor memory. And in those checks, they call this uhlog function, which is primarily used for logging, but it can also induce kernel panics if the first parameter is a literal uppercase D. And so those checks are important because there's a security boundary between kernel and hypervisor land. And the problem is when they check the kernel input, they try to check that physical address against protected ranges. But when the check fails, they log it with the capital L, not the capital D. So it logs the warning, but no panic ever actually occurs. So you could basically write into hypervisor protected memory, which gives you a privilege escalation to EL2, which is quite a significant privilege escalation.
Yeah, so yeah, I'll mention, the issue here is they have this check kernel input and it literally does nothing.
Yeah.
This function, it does the check, spends the CPU time on it, but because that they should have either had a return, well, also include the brackets or braces, but a return under that uhlog to, return false. Well, no, I guess that won't work here, too, because it's only returning. How's this used in the hierarchy? Either way, they should have ideally die if they do that, but I'm surprised, that this wouldn't have been caught any sooner. I mean, I get the fact that it's hard to kind of hit this code, to get this code to even see it and get started there. That's why this is an amazing post for all of the background information that's there. This will enable a lot of research to not need to do a lot of this yourself. Absolutely. It will be a game changer in a sense. But it's just surprising that an issue, do they have no check that actually tested, the failure case? Because this went to fail, it couldn't fail.
Yeah, I mean, this is This seems to be like a common theme with Samsung, because we've covered Samsung security subsystems before, and it seems like they have a really good intent. The idea is really cool, and it's like, wow, that sounds like a great idea. And then you look at the implementation, and they have some really silly bugs in the implementation. It's like the ideas are there, but the code quality just isn't. I don't know. It's something strange with Samsung specifically. I don't know, with their security subsystems. But yeah, like you said, a code review should have caught this, or just any level of like testing. But
yeah, I mean, any test that tested if it failed would have caught this.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be one of those things where when you're talking about like test-driven development, there is a big push to make thing to make sure things succeed the way they're supposed to. But it seems something that gets missed often is the negative check. Checking that errors actually happen the way they're supposed to is something that's not done very often and clearly wasn't done here. So that's an example of how that can screw you in the end. But one final point I thought was interesting was the mitigation support for the three mitigations I mentioned earlier. They vary depending on whether the device is a high-end or low-end device and which region it is. So only USA high-end devices have all three. International high-end don't have the ROP prevention, and international and USA low-end only have the kernel data protection. I'm not totally sure why this is the case. It might be something with Exynos chips versus Snapdragon chips. If I remember correctly, the Exynos, or however you say that, I never say it the same way twice. Those chips, I think, are less powerful, and thus they might be harder hit in the performance by those mitigations. In fact, that seems the most likely to me, but that is purely just a guess based on what I know between the two different chips.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, why not the ROP one then? Like on the high-end international, why doesn't the high-end international have all three? Because I mean, the ROP one, it is just like instrumenting that's actually just a staff canary, which, okay, does have a bit of an overhead, but I don't know. I mean, on the high-end devices, I feel like it should be doable.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's just
it's weird. I did notice probably, that.
Yeah, I think it's just they had to make like a trade off, and the trade off just wasn't worth it for the international phones because the performance just isn't there. But
yeah, I mean, I don't think many people are going to be buying these devices because it's got the ROP prevention. Like, I don't think that's a selling point for most people.
No, most people who are like really security conscious will. I mean, if they're really, really worried about it, they're probably not even going to buy, like, you know, your mainline phones. Or
they'll get something they
can
flash themselves, at the very least.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, like you said, this is a very in-depth research post. This is kind of akin to the attacking JavaScript engines paper by Salo a couple years ago for browsers. I think this is like the equivalent of that for Samsung Android research. So yeah, I mean, this is definitely one to keep bookmarked, in my opinion. Even though it is really long, I think it's worth checking out if you're interested in that kind of stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of information in here. It'll be interesting to know if they change kind of their JOP and ROP implementations over the years, because I can see especially the JOP one getting done to something a bit more granular. But even ignoring that, like, there's a lot of just internals information that isn't too likely to change too quickly. I mean, some of the details might change, but you're getting the big picture here, too.
Yeah, especially when you're talking about hypervisors and stuff. That's not something people really want to touch. And the dev teams for that are pretty, like, you don't have, like, you know, 1,000 people working on a hypervisor. So, yeah, that code isn't really subject to change as much. And one thing this post speaks to, and some of these mitigations speak to, is just the power of hypervisors. It's why you're starting to see hypervisors come up kind of everywhere, especially with like Hyper-V. Hyper-V is being pushed by Microsoft heavily. Even Windows 10 Home Editions, which don't officially have Hyper-V support for you to be able to run VMs, it still uses Hyper-V under the hood for some of the mitigations that Microsoft has.
Yeah, well, I believe
hypervisors
now,
are just so strong for security. They're getting better.
With the WSL2 release. I believe that also brought that now, like, W10 is run. Somebody might be able to correct me on that. I believe it's basically run under the hypervisor now.
Yeah.
And that also enables, like, Windows Defender has several mitigations that are based around that. Of course, if you go to Pro, you do get more. There are several significant improvements there, but a hypervisor is, like, you know, it controls the operating system, and soon enough, you know, kernel exploits are going to be the hypervisor exploits. You're trying to get into that ring -1 instead of just ring 0.
It's yet another layer of security. Taking a question out of chat, why can't you jump in the middle of an instruction on ARM? Is that like a thing by design? That's because ARM expects all instructions to be aligned, because it's all instructions. It's a fixed instruction size in ARM. That's its big selling point, is it's a reduced instruction set. It's not complex like x86. Because all the instructions are the same size, they flow through the pipeline a lot better. There's no mid instruction stream jumping.
Yeah, with x86, because the instructions are different sizes, as Spectre was kind of touching on, you can have like one set of bytes that might be interpretable in like three different ways, depending on where you start at, or more than three different ways. And so that's abused with a lot of ROP chains on x86. You get a lot more gadgets that way, whereas on ARM, your gadgets are limited to the actual instructions that are intended to be there, rather than the middle of an instruction.
Yeah. With that said, we can start to move into our shoutouts section. So we can start off with analyzing ZVE 2020-16040. This is another really long blog post, and it's a complex post. It's an analysis of a Chrome V8 NDA, which is a bug in the JIT compiler optimization in the simplified lowering phase. Obviously, when you're talking about JIT, it gets really complicated. When you're talking about JIT optimization, it gets even more complicated than that. Honestly, I tried giving this a read-through, and it's a really high barrier of entry for reading. A lot of it did kind of pass over my head. If you're not familiar with JIT internals and how the optimizer works, you're probably not going to have a great time trying to read this.
Yeah, like last time when we covered, because we covered another issue that dealt with turbofans and the optimizer. In particular, it was in the de-optimizer, and I was able to kind of get through that one. But I mean, as somebody that hasn't done any work in this area, this looks like a really interesting write-off, but it definitely kind of went beyond me in numerous ways that I just couldn't dig into. That said, we still want to call it out, because there's a lot of information here again. And the browser exploits, some of the gadgets, like, they're always kind of worth checking out, and it's worth being aware of, you know, when somebody publishes a write-up like this.
Yeah, I will quickly shout out, I believe it was episode 49 when we last covered a JIT optimization bug. So, trying to see if I can find exactly what it was. But yeah, episode 49 is where you can find that. And we have timestamps in all of our videos on YouTube.
Yeah, that was the DOS to RCE one. That was the, it was reported as a no pointer dereference.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, honestly, like, I think it's still worth shouting out because it's got some good background information. And if you can dedicate a lot of time into reading it, or you're already familiar with browser internals, there's definitely things you can take away here. It's just be warned, if you're not in the browser area, this will be tough to read through it and might not be, the post for you. I had another shout out as well. It's a tool, Hex Lasso Online. This is just like a little site that got published recently. It allows you to do some static analysis of binaries. The restrictions on size are pretty heavy. The files you upload can't be larger than 256 kilobytes, but I still thought it was cool and can shout it out. Some of the things it allows you to do is you can analyze for like the most frequent bytes that are found, look for ASCII printable strings, look for x86 code fragments. There's a few other neat features in there. Tools like IDA and stuff kind of already have these kinds of features, but this being an online tool, I think I use online tools a lot, actually, when I'm doing like research and stuff, just because I can quickly search on Google for the tool, or if I have it bookmarked, just go to the bookmark, paste something in really quick and get what I'm looking for without having to open up a tool, which will probably take even longer than just doing it online. So I just wanted to shout out the tool because I think it might be useful for some people out there who are doing any binary analysis or anything like that.
It could be useful. Do you know if there were any screenshots somewhere? I thought I had... Oh, yeah, actually, right as I say that, I pulled up the page that at least has a screenshot.
Yeah, there you
shows
go.
Some of the analyzation that I can do.
Yeah,
yeah, so... I mean, it's... Again, it's one of those things. It's worth being aware of. I don't know how much I'd go for a hex editor online, or like this, or hex analysis online, but... I could see why somebody would.
Yeah. So with that said, I believe you had a final shout out, Z.
Yeah, this one is another one of those papers that just goes beyond me. This is a electromagnetic side channel to break Google's Titan security keys. I think just one of them in particular, it wasn't all of their Titan security keys. But these are basically like your standard FIDO U2F type keys. I believe this issue actually did impact, impacted the YubiKey Neo. Oh, and they do say Google security key or Titan security key, all versions. That said, electromagnetic side channel over my head. there's a paper that goes along with it if you're interested in that. I want to call it out, though, because, I mean, they're breaking a security key. There's got to be something interesting in that. I just can't speak intelligently about it.
All right. So I think we'll wrap up the show there. Thanks to everyone who tuned in. I do want to give a shout-out to Nahomsek. He does some really cool streams on hacking around, doing bug bounties and stuff like that. So, a lot of and you did come from his stream, but for those of you who didn't, I'd recommend going and checking it out. And thanks again for the raid.
And we've talked about some of his issues on here before, so.
Yeah, for sure. So with that said, you can catch our VODs on Twitch or on YouTube at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific on Tuesday after the stream. Previous podcasts are also up on Spotify, and more links are on Anchor. We have a Discord and a Twitter, so feel free to join that and follow us. You can find the links at the bottom of the page or in the description of the video if you're watching the VOD. We'll be back again next Monday at the usual time, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Pacific, and we will see you all next week.